Hi, I'm Doug Keck, and welcome to The Catholic Sphere. You know, this is the show where we tackle topics important to Catholics around the globe with a different host and a different focus. This week, our subject is theology, and our topic is stating your rights, the mob, the people, or the party. Who decides? Today, we welcome our distinguished panel of experts. Back with us, EW10's Vice President of Theology, Colin Donovan. He is in our theology studio. We also have the host of EWTN Radio's Call to Communion, Dr. David Andrews. He's in our radio studio, naturally. And finally, we're joined remotely by moral theologian, author, and papal missionary Mercy and EWTN host, does a lot, Father Jeffrey Kirby, and he's joining us from South Carolina. Welcome, gentlemen. Great to have you back on our panel, kind of for a part two, talking about who gives us our rights. Now, this particular topic talks more about the idea, as the topic says, the mob, the people, or the party, or in many cases, the state. Now, as far as the Catholic Church is concerned, according to the Magis Center AI, the state cannot explicitly or implicitly limit or subjectivize inalienable rights such as the right to life, etc. Also, and I thought this was important, and we'll play off of this, the legitimacy of the state itself rests upon its universal protection of the inalienable rights of all of its citizens. So let me ask you, Colin Donovan, what are your thoughts about the idea that the state itself only really exists for the protection of its own people?
Well, I think that's certainly closer truth to the truth in the conception of it. The basic cell of society is the individual, and then the family, and then each of the larger societies. You know, here in America, we have cities and counties and states, and finally we have the federal government. So all of these agglomerations of peoples, these societies, really exist to serve the common good, as the Church's teaching says, of all. And so that common good is necessarily dependent upon, you know, what kind of a creature is man and what serves its needs and what gives it to all human beings a common basis for society, for its life, and maybe in the words of one of our founding documents, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, basically, mm-hmm. is another way of putting that. So other forms of thinking in government certainly can be devised, and we talked about those in the last program as well. But I think in the context of this program, you know, the question is what happens when it isn't based on man's nature? It isn't inalienable rights. But what happens if the government controls it? Mm-hmm. We have many historical examples of that. What happens if the mob? And there it's a particular meaning as to what is meant by mob. It was sort of Plato's worst dream of what would happen in a democracy, mm-hmm. when the people with the lowest passions, the people with lack of virtue, can get into control. And then there is no rhyme or reason to what the government does. And so it means the sort of the worst case scenario of democracy. Or what happens when the people, and they're specifically meaning what our form of government says, what does that mean, and how is that in keeping with the sense of rights which we've been discussing in these two programs? And then, obviously, the party is a collection of people, too, like a city or a government, but of a particular way of thinking. What happens when it's the party that determines the right or its own interests or the interests of the entire country? So there are different groups of people you could look at to say, right, well, what would be the effect of them imposing their view of society in a democracy?
Right. I guess that's why Plato wanted philosopher kings to be running things rather than letting the mob decide in any particular election there.
Would have been his ideal.
At least his idea in his republic. It's interesting, too, because the Greeks themselves, one of them one time said, once people can vote themselves good things that they want for themselves, rather than voting because it's what's good for the city or for the country itself, but from a personal interest, a democracy falls apart, which is why we don't have a direct democracy. And let me ask you, Dr. Andrews, one of the things that gets pointed out in the piece that I got from the Magis Center. Says rights conflict within the state, such as those between one person's right to life and another's liberty, must be resolved by objective criteria grounded in natural law, not by arbitrary decisions or political majorities. And that's where I think it gets into, like, the idea of the mob. This idea that, you know, well, this is what the majority of the people want. But yet most of those people who say that many times are the same people who are concerned about the rights of minority when it's on the other side.
Well, that's exactly right. And you know, the minority question in the United States, of course, is a deeply neuralgic one, and it's very painful for a lot of people. Probably no one in American history is more of a luminary, more of an iconic figure in this discussion than Martin Luther King Jr., who we alluded to in the last discussion we had on this subject, and his famous iconic letter from the Birmingham jail presupposes the idea that there is a justice, there's a nature of the right and the good that's transcendent to law, and it's definitely transcendent to the passions of the majority. I mean, that's at the heart of the civil rights movement, and that by appealing to that, you can actually appeal to the consciences of your oppressor, and that as human beings, as men and women, King had faith that they could recognize in themselves the seeds of the justice that they were in fact violating. And so it was an appeal against the mob to the mob's own better instincts. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, too. Let me ask you a follow-up on that. I was thinking along these lines as well, is that many times you'll hear somebody when they talk about, you know, if you say, well, I really like this socialist idea, and somebody says, well, look at what they did in Russia. And it's always, well, they didn't quite do it right. They overdid it this way. You know, somehow we'll be smarter and do it better. And sometimes it seems like we even have that sometimes in the Christian churches, let alone the Catholic Church, where it's like, well, God's got it mostly right, but it's a couple of things that need to be fixed better. And we see the results of that. It usually doesn't work out very well.
No, it doesn't. And of course, socialism, and it's not the only economic ideology out there on offer. And this is one of the reasons the church stands against ideologies as such, not only socialism, is because they reduce the human person to his productive and consumptive aspect. And that is, of course, a necessary part of human life, but it's not the most elevating, and it's not where most of us find our deepest sense of meaning, which comes from the transcendent element of the human personality, our capacity to seek the truth, to make moral judgments, to live in society and seek the good of the other, and not just his material and economic well-being, but his spiritual well-being, his social well-being. And in any economic system or political system that just reduces us, you know, to consumption or production is inherently dehumanizing. And so even if you could perfectly realize the Soviet or the socialist dream, which of course is impossible, you would still leave a denuded personality in a miserable society.
Mm-hmm. Right. Let me ask you, Father Kirby, thinking about that, and I think in the last program you might have brought up the tribal idea. And in a sense, as Colin outlaid, you know, the mob, I mean, basically, again, this kind of tribal identity politics that people are no longer individuals. In one case, we're incredibly individualistic. In other ways, we totally identified as groups. So we're dealing in a world where it used to be, I know when I was a kid, and I'm old, I remember when we were called the melting pot. That was the idea. Everybody kind of came in, and it all kind of came together, and different aspects of different cultures enhanced what was already here, but ultimately it was for the betterment. And it seems like in the last, let's say, 30, 40, maybe 50 years, that's this concept of the mosaic. Okay, well, it's not really a melting pot, it's a mosaic. But the problem with a mosaic is that it looks like from a distance it's all together, but when you get up close to it, you realize it's all made up of separate parts.
Yes, yes, yeah. And just as we talk about, you know, being older, just a glimpse, when I was in school, elementary school, middle school, early high school, and I went to public schools in the United States. And, you know, yet, you know, I read about Antigone in ancient Greece, who defied the orders of her uncle King to bury the body of her father and appealed to the gods. And I read, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail. And we read Animal Farm, which is a really creative way to kind of expose a lot of what we're actually talking about when positive law takes over, especially of various forms of communism. And I think what happens is just to appeal to that is, you know, that's not what young people are being asked to read anymore. And you know, the reason why is because literature like that reminds us of the fact that we are, you know, the children of a common creator, of a common father. We are mutually human beings with an inherent dignity. Let me throw in To Kill a Mockingbird, a powerful book I had to read when I was in middle school. I still recount parts of that novel. And these were things that we taught because it was an understanding of the common good, that we live in a society that, yes, of course, we can have cultural differences and expressions. And, you know, there are some beautiful things that enhance our society because we do them differently. But at the core, at the heart, we are bound as one. And so if we want to use the image of the melting pot, that helps us, that there is a certain give and take. And we can do that because what unites us, what allows us to be a people is not these cultural expressions or these views, political or cultural, but what unites us is that we have a common creator. Mm-hmm. And so there can be give and take. There can be a certain comfort in saying, well, okay, I'm going to adjust this cultural expression, or I'm going to reevaluate this belief that I've had in order to try to adjust and be a part of this common good, of this people. You know, and so I think when we throw out the creator, and that's no longer a source of unity, well, then eventually, and sometimes we have a few generations to work into it, which I think we've seen in the West and in the United States, eventually what we have is tribalism, because it's my, even our society uses this term, my truth, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we used to call those opinions, you know? Mm-hmm. And yet there's this battle of my truth versus your truth, because we can't even acknowledge that there's simply the truth anymore. And of course, that flows from the fact that we have dethroned the creator as the center of our society. So I think definitely we're going to have these bizarre images of, you know, a mosaic, or recently I was reading about, you know, we're a salad bowl, so mm-hmm. we're all different pieces within there. Mm-hmm. And so on, and these, you know, images that are used to attempts at creativity, but at the end of the day, it leaves us more divided than united.
Right, absolutely. Colin, let me ask you, because so many times we've talked about in the last show, and this show, and even here, that the robust understanding of natural rights is central in Catholic social teaching, and certainly in how we view the underpinnings here in the United States. But when we say that, what do we mean by natural law? What do we mean by natural rights? Can you give us an overview of what that means for people?
Well, that means, and here I'll give you the Thomistic view because I think it's the one which is the most rational and coherent. And that is God in creating us, that the very act of creation on his part constituted us a being of a certain kind. And that nature is what gives us the law, as it were. Reading that nature is to read the law of God, and it's common to all human beings on the planet. So it can be discovered everywhere by any group of people, and has in varying degrees. The value of revelation then becomes the fact that it is known with a greater certainty because it's revealed. Because we see that, for instance, the law regarding life, the cannibals didn't accept that. They had a blind spot regarding that. Our culture has a blind spot on abortion and many other things. And it's not because the dignity of life is suddenly missing from the unborn child or from others, but because there's a blindness there that is preventing us from seeing it. So the nature is there to be read, and what you tend to get is you get kind of get usurpations of different kinds, as we've been talking. And in all of those cases, it's always true that individuals are more harmed than served by what is typically the serving of a particular need, whether it's a tribal need. You know, our group wants this, give us this group. You know, and we'll be on your side on things. This is the old Roman idea of pane et circi, bread and circuses. Mm-hmm. You know, keep them fed, keep them entertained, and you've got a nice client mob behind you. And this sort of is the way our politics is proceeding, rather than, as the church teaches, on common working together all individuals, regardless of the flavors of, you know, that each party may give to a particular policy, all working together for the common good. The common good has to be based on something. And when we've lost the nature of the common good founded in human nature. And that's why I think in large part our politics in the United States are so broken up and so tragic.
Let me ask you, Dr. Anders, on that. It seems like there's been, though we don't have Chesterton with us, so we don't. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of common sense around anymore. But that idea of the common good runs counter to the other side of the equation we have. We've got this identity politics group, but we also got this incredible individualism. Which we see with that kind of my truth idea and the idea that basically I'm autonomous and I can believe what I want to believe and do what I want to do. And nobody can tell me what's the right thing for me to do and stop me from doing what I want to do.
No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I think the part of the impetus for the tribalism, the identity politics, the my truth is that people are resistant to the idea that there is such a thing as a common human nature from which we can have an idea of a common good or a general good. The other thing, you know, at the outset of the show, you mentioned the idea that the government is there to protect us in one way or the other. And that is, of course, a function of the government. But early in earlier modern political thought, in the likes of Hobbes, for example, you have this idea that man in the state of nature is just a rapacious animal, and that the function of government is simply to keep us from getting at each other's throats.
Right.
That my rights simply stop at your sovereignty and
right.
and
at
that's
your
it.
Chin no more, or your face.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
there's no more exalted vision of life and society other than just keeping the gorillas at bay, right? But what we all know at some level of our experience is that we're not satisfied living a purely atomistic and individual life, because we all seek to live in society or community of some kind. That's why there are these tribes. I mean, the reason that that young kids are going online and finding, you know, radical groups to join is because they want to have some sort of transcendent purpose in something that's bigger than themselves. And we all are drawn to that. It's intrinsic to our nature and our search for meaning and belonging. And a properly ordered government doesn't just keep us from each other's throats, but it facilitates these subsidiary organizations, these orders of society that are, you know, beginning with the individual and the family, but transcending them to local communities and other forms of association, and respects those as an integral part of the human good, right? I mean, it's like, there's a difference between singing a solo and singing in a choir. You can achieve something in the collective that's intrinsically beautiful that can't be achieved on one's own. And I think even people who philosophically reject the idea of a common nature or a common good, they don't reject the innate desire to find these transcendent sources of meaning. That's why they group themselves into tribes in the first place.
Let me ask you, Father Kirby, one of the things too, I wonder, with a lot of this kind of identity politics kind of thing, the wokeness, some of which hopefully is fading a little bit, that contagion at least of, trans seems to be calming itself down. The numbers have dropped dramatically already. But there seems to be a lot of this in an Alinsky-like idea that one uses these issues or puffs up these issues as basically power politics. That if I can mobilize a group, I need to have somebody. Hitler saw this with the Jews. He had to find somebody that was the enemy that everybody else could blame for their problems. And that's what we see in this group management in the United States as well.
Exactly. And what empowers that, you know, false understanding is when through education or lack of formation or a lack of coercion, the dignity of the person, the understanding God is our creator, we do have a shared humanity, that there is a mutual dignity. When that's removed, well then, yes, like, you know, all bets are off. You can do whatever you want, say whatever you want, cause whatever harm you want. And then suddenly, in order to kind of rally the masses to your side, you just pick the most controversial or most difficult issue, you take the issue, you exaggerate it, you cover it in kind of a pseudo nobility, you make, you know, redefine moral terms in order to assert those terms. I mean, let's be honest, like gay marriage would not be, so-called gay marriage would not be legal in this country if the gay movement had not surrounded itself with the residue of the civil rights movement. So this whole notion of justice and equality, that's how this eventually became, you know, this part of our society now, this whole notion of gay marriage. And the same with the transgender. It's, well, you have to respect them, or, you know, they have a dignity, you have to have justice. Again, all these terms that are either radically incomplete or just plain misdefined, mm-hmm. and then suddenly it rallies people, it gets people upset. And the ones who are opposing, rather than sitting and saying, let's talk, let us allow reason to prevail. No, instead, it's I don't have to respect you. I don't have to listen to you. You're wrong. Be quiet. If you're not quiet, I'll hurt you. And this provocation of fear. You know, Doug, let me just say there are many Christians who will not take a stand in terms of the person of the unborn because they are afraid of their neighbors. They are afraid of their coworkers. And this is the society that we have when suddenly there's no longer this understanding of a mutual dignity for all human beings, an understanding of a shared human nature, the understanding that God is creator, that there are greater things than political differences or different cultural emphases, there are higher things than those. And when we lose that, then everything else becomes exaggerated and we become easy prey. When you look at the activists, I see this in the young church with our young Christians, how they are just used as sheep by these activists, in large part because there's us versus them. Them is always wrong. This is where we stand. We're morally right, however they define morals. And it becomes this battle of the wills. I mean, Nietzsche would be jealous of what we have been able to establish here in the United States with this battle of the wills between us and them and this this retrieval of tribalism.
Right. Well, let me ask you, Colin, and maybe this can go to all the panel one by one if we have the time, but the idea of there seems to be a lot of confusion, obviously, in our society, especially over the last 25, 30 years between the media. You know, we don't know who women are. We don't know who men are. Gay marriage, all of these kinds of things that we used to think were issues don't seem to be issues. And one of the things Father Kirby mentioned was the idea of people not standing up. Well, a lot of cases, I think people are afraid to stand up, not only because of their own self, but because they're not sure where that position fits with what the official church is saying at any given time. That there seems to be, and I think it's clear, regardless of the end result, that many times a lot of statements seem to be somewhat confusing, even today, to give people the feeling, well, is this good or bad? Is the seamless garment, are all these things equal and the same? I should be upset about abortion to the same level I'm upset about welcoming a stranger or the immigrant. I mean, there's a lot of confusion there too, isn't there?
Well, there is, but on the other hand, the church teaching does sort all of that things out, because we know there are a hierarchy of goods, and so some goods precede others. Like, obviously, if you don't have life, you can't worry about, you know, medical care, you can't worry about migrating, you can't worry about issues of justice and prison and so on. So there's always going to be a hierarchy of goods that can be used to help sort through those things. Typically, I think it is certainly true that if statements coming from those with authority are not clear, it can confuse in people's minds who do not have any innate ability to put things in this hierarchy, mm-hmm. and be misleading. So clarity of thought, clarity of teaching is certainly very important. You can always go, if people wonder on particular things, to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, or to the compendium of the social teaching of the church. Mm-hmm. Both of those officially bring together the sources of the magisterium which have spoken on issues and can help bring clarity into maybe the confusing mm-hmm. statement thrown out offhand in an interview, right, or to a journalist or something. coming from any particular level of the church.
Right. Let me ask you, Dr. Anders, kind of follow up on that. Also, the idea that sometimes you can be in a situation, and we even have it with our laws, where the law doesn't change, but our enforcement of the law changes. So effectively, though the law is still there, effectively, there's no prosecution. And you could even make the case some places, times it seems in the church, that something doesn't change doctrinally, but it doesn't seem to carry the same weight that it may be used to.
Oh, I think that's definitely true. I think that's absolutely true. I mean, in the civil sphere, if I understand it correctly, prosecutors have the law on paper, but then they have a policy position that they call their prosecutorial guidelines. And so there can be instances where there are flagrant violations of law, and there can be an explicit policy of not prosecuting a particular crime because it doesn't meet whatever the criteria are. Now, some of those guidelines may be rational, like if you're working for the ATF and you have to decide whether to go after somebody with an illegal handgun, but you only have enough resources, you know, to do one thing at a time, and over here you have a street gang that's got a whole, you know, ton of machine guns that they're using to take out city blocks. Well, even you have to prioritize your enforcement, right? Obviously, so there's some rational basis for that. But to be sure, that can also become subject to political manipulation and ideological agendas and so forth. I think obviously the same thing is going to happen in the church. You know, on my radio show, I often get questions from people that say, why doesn't my priest preach about X, you know, more than he does? Why doesn't he say this, you know? And I usually try to give the priest the benefit of the doubt, of course, but it's always possible that somebody's not a straight shooter and that their own ideological prejudice color their presentation of the faith. But to be fair, sometimes a priest may be in a particular parish where he has to make prudent judgments about how to bring his particular congregation along. I mean, I remember a case that I know of quite close to home where there was a quite orthodox and conservative priest who wanted to move his parish more in line with the rubrics of the Mass and liturgical orthodoxy, but out of pastoral prudence, he was willing to take, you know, several months to get there. He didn't come in and lay it all down on the first day. So there's different ways to interpret that depending on the context.
Okay, very good. We're going to have a leave it there, gentlemen. Lively conversation. Thank you so much, Colin Donovan, as always, Dr. David Anders and Father Jeffrey Kirby, for being with us today. And we thank you, as always, for joining us. And don't forget to join us next week, right here on the Catholic Sphere. See you then.